This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Good evening to you all, and the sponsors tonight are Bill and Josette Flicker. Josette has been a regular this year, and we thank them for their generosity, and their sponsorship reads that it is in honor of our parents and in the memory of Norman Flicker, Marcel Cohen, Sanya Blattner, and Jacob Shabit. Reads, dear Rabbi Lachman, thank you for giving us access to Torah in its purity, essence, and complexity. You are changing and enriching our lives and our souls. It's from the Flickers. Thank you very much for that, Joseph. I appreciate that. We started a series last week dealing with the management of some of the paradoxes of life, created by the Torah, in fact. And we dealt last week with the concept of paradox itself in general terms, and we introduced the whole concept of paradox last week, and particularly about the paradox between what we term chok and what we term mishpat. And we defined chok and mishpat in a very particular way last week. We defined mishpat as a law that is spun off by a moral principle, and chok is a moral principle that is spun off by a law. So when you start with a principle and that yields various laws, those laws are called mishpatim. When you start off with a law that you would never have thought of, that man would never have created, God creates that law. But in our attempts to understand that law, we spin off new insights, new understandings, new moral concepts, new philosophic precepts. Those are called chukim. That law is called a chok, a statute. And we said that, in fact, it's not that the Torah is divided up into laws that are mishpatim and laws that are chukim, but rather that in every law, in every principle, not only in every principle of the Torah, but also in every principle of life, there is chok. And we termed chok as the mystery within reason. There is reason, there is rationale, but there is nothing that is so rational that it escapes the mysterious. There is nothing in life, there is nothing in science, there is nothing in law, there is nothing in the Torah, there is nothing in philosophy that is so rational that there is nothing irrational about it, or there's nothing non-rational about it, there's nothing super-rational about it. Everything that we have, every concept that we have, it's really just a matter of degree. How much of it appears rational with a deep, irrational, super-rational soul, and how much of it has very little body to it, and it's all soul. So when we talk about a chok, when in the Torah we classify certain laws as a chok, those laws are laws that have little body and much soul. Whereas when we talk about a mishpat, we're talking about a law that has little, less soul and a lot more body. The difference is that where there's mishpat, we can relate to it using our minds, and later on get beyond that, get into the soul stuff. But when we're dealing with a chok, we cannot gain access using our minds. When we're dealing with a chok, our only access is with our souls, with our neshamas. And we discussed last week a very difficult concept of the ability to access soul with soul. Please sit down. We're dealing with really difficult concepts, and I would appreciate it. In fact, if somebody could mention outside that nobody else should come in, it's terribly distracting. Could somebody just give a message outside there that anybody who's there should come in now, and anybody who's not there, it's late already, it's not a working day, it's too late to come into the shiur. It really disturbs me and it disturbs everybody else. The concept of being able to access soul with soul, that one can in fact only access soul with soul. There isn't another tool that we have that we can use to access neshama, to access soul. And we access soul in many different areas, in an interpersonal contact. We will sometimes access one another on a very superficial level, with what we look like to one another. We will access one another on a slightly deeper level, with what we say to one another. What we say on a superficial level and what we say on a deeper level. But we're still using our senses and our intellects at those levels. But there's a much deeper level that very occasionally we access each other on. And that's when we access each other soul to soul. Not where I use my mind to try and figure out what your soul is about. My mind cannot figure out what your soul is about. And your mind cannot figure out what my soul is about. If there's going to be a soul-to-soul connection, it's going to have to operate at the level of the neshama, at the level of the soul, not at the level of the mind. But we explained last week that we're dealing with something very dangerous here. And that is once we move off the strictly rational, we enter into an area that is so subjective in potential that it runs the risk of being illusionary. How do you know when you're on soul stuff? People, as we mentioned last week, make a lot of money create a lot of fame out of pretending to be involved in soul activities. Because who would know? If anybody feels something emotional, they think it's soul. If they feel something deep, they think it's soul. All it has to be is deeper than anything they felt before, and they think it's soul. They don't really have a grasp of how deep the soul really is. Because nearly all of us, for nearly all of our lives, have never felt anything in the soul. Whatever we're feeling is above the soul. The human being is amazingly deep. When I say it's above the soul, it doesn't mean it's on the surface. There are millions of miles between the surface and the soul. And there are some things that we feel that are very, very deep inside us, but it's not soul. And we discussed last week how for the soul to be able to access soul, two things need to be in place. Years of training and experience on the rational, and then sanctity. The neshama only operates in an environment of sanctity. So one has to have a level of sanctity oneself. One has to be operating in an environment of sanctity. The relationship has to be one that contains sanctity. That's something very rare. We're talking about incredibly great levels and heights of achievement that the ordinary person doesn't easily reach. Now that doesn't mean that therefore the ordinary person is barred from ever experiencing soul. Occasionally there's a spark, a little spark of something that is soul. And he has to be able to recognize that and try and grasp that and build on that and understand that. And there are a few points that came up after the last shiur that I want to clarify before I move on to the next topic. The one point we said is, you remember that the Rashi commented that when Moshe criticized God for making the Jews' lives even harder in Egypt than it was initially, and he says to God, you haven't performed, you haven't delivered. The reason you sent me was to ease the burden. And the Jews quite rightly say that ever since we've got involved, God and Moses, things have gotten worse for the Jews. And God comes down very heavily on him and says in a very subtle note, Moshe, you will see what I'm going to do to Pharaoh now, but you won't see what I'm going to do to the seven kings of Israel when the Jewish people get to Israel, because you will not get there. Why not? Because you haven't shown the kind of faith that Abraham showed. When I told Abraham to sacrifice his only son, after having told him that his future is through the son and that he will build a great nation through the son, and before the son is even married, I tell him to sacrifice the son, surely Avram should have said, but God, that doesn't make sense. And Avram didn't say that. He blindly took the son and sacrificed him. And you're questioning me. And there the question was asked, but that leaves Avraham looking like quite a weak sort of character. God says, sacrifice your son. He says, yes. God says, your son will be the greatest nation in the world. He says, thank you. Sacrifice your son, yes. Where is Avram's character? What's important to understand, when Avraham was asked to sacrifice his son, Avraham was already 100 years old. Avraham had spent a century using his mind to analyze God and the world and the Torah as he knew it and as he had it at that time. So as we said earlier on and last week, that soul access comes after a lifetime of sophisticated and skilled and competent reasoning. Then you start on the soul. Avraham, don't forget, had learnt God with his brain for decades already. He knew God thoroughly with his brain. He got to the point where he no longer had to check God out rationally. But he didn't get there on the first day. He didn't get there because he went to some spiritual seance or happening and he was told to abandon his intellect and do whatever this God told him to do. That's not what happened. This is a man who'd studied and reasoned and analyzed and challenged and questioned for years and years and years before he even experienced God. According to some views, he was 70 before he had the first affirmation that God existed. For 70 years, he challenged conceptually and philosophically the question of who made the world, who masters the world, who owns the world, who directs the world, is there a God, isn't there a God? He engaged in dialogue with all the intellectual leaders of his age for 70 years before there was any kind of spiritual sensing of God saying, yes, I'm here, Avraham, you've discovered me. 70 years was a lifetime. This is not a person who walks into a Kabbalah center or to a Shabbos table and walks out a few minutes later saying he's experienced God. No, you don't experience God like that. 70 years in yeshiva of using your mind day and night, and then you might be ready to start using yourself. If you start using the soul before then, how do you know if it's the soul or if it's the imagination? How do you know? And so it's true, Avraham got to a point where he didn't need to question. That's the highest level, to get to a point where you don't need to question. And if you start working philosophically, you could say, you could question anything. How do I know that any other human being exists? How do I know? It might purely be subjective senses. How do I know that two human beings see the same things? That you and I are seeing and experiencing the same thing? Maybe I just hear you, the way you talk to me, I interpret it to mean the same, but maybe it isn't. One can go crazy questioning these things. So imagine a husband and wife living together, and the husband says, what would you like for, the wife says, what would you like for dinner tonight? And he says one question. Firstly, let's establish, do I exist? Having established whether I exist, let's establish whether you exist. Let's get into that, and one, if we're sure, absolutely certain, that both you exist and I exist, then we'll discuss whether chicken exists. You don't live like that. There comes a point where you don't have to go through that process. You know enough to be able to say yes, no, to be able to answer immediately. There's an experience of the reality of the other person that makes questioning insulting. You don't have to question. Avraham got to a level that we're all meant to get to someday, where questioning is no longer necessary. Not because we've abdicated questioning, but because we've exhausted questioning. We've questioned to the end. We've questioned to the ultimate. We've gone as far as our minds will allow us to go. And we know God from a rational perspective as completely as one can know him rationally. And now we're ready to move into accessing him by soul. And again, I would like to emphasize over and over again, that doesn't mean that until the day you've finished with the rational, you don't start the soul. Obviously, it's a gradual area and there's overlap. But what I'm suggesting is it takes a long time and enormous skills and competence of rational engaging with God before the soul even begins, certainly before one gets to a point where you can rely on the soul and no longer need to question. So when God says to Moshe, Avraham got to the level where he didn't question me, that's talking about a level he got to after a century. And God says to Moshe was also an elderly man at that time. You've also experienced me, although we discussed last week that Moshe's experience of God until he suffered the consequence of hitting the rock was nowhere near as painful as the experience that somebody like Avraham had and others. Another point, three people came after the shiur and in different ways made comments about faith. One person said to me that if I'm looking for topics to talk about, a good topic would be faith. But that person isn't here tonight. Another person came and said that they noticed that I didn't talk about faith. Is that because faith is irrational and I was talking about the rational? But that person is also not here tonight. But the third person, Francina, asked a question, and what was important about her question was the way she formulated, and she is here tonight. And therefore, as I said to her last week, the question was formulated so precisely that it's worthy of a whole shiur, not just of a quick answer. And the way she put it was, is faith chok or is it mishpat? That's a longisha question. That's a yeshiva question. That's not just a philosophic question. Is faith this? Is faith chok or is it mishpat? Is faith rational? Is faith a principle that we ought to know that generates all sorts of consequence? Or is faith something that we wouldn't know, that we're given? And from that we're able to work out the consequences. What starts? Does it start with a rational principle that has logical outcomes? Or is it a non-rational principle that has logical outcomes? Is it chok or is it mishpat? And although I said last week we were going to deal with the topic of when bad things happen to good people, where's the justice? That topic is going to take us at least 2 weeks. Starting tonight, we're going to start tonight dealing with faith. I realized from those questions that there's a missing link between what we did last week and what we need to do. Dealing with the question of the justice of bad things happening to good people, the whole question comes of what is faith? What are we supposed to believe? And how do we deal with that belief as a precursor to the main discussion which we'll have next week. So tonight we're going to be talking about faith. And here I'm talking not about faith, because faith, we use two different words in Hebrew for faith. The one is emuno, and the second is bitachon. Emuno means belief, and bitachon means trust. And faith is both of them. One can say, I believe in God. Does that mean I have faith? No, it just means I believe there is a God. Sometimes he's asleep, sometimes he's awake, sometimes he notices me, sometimes he doesn't notice, but I believe in him. That's belief, but it's not faith. Faith is something much more than that. Faith is trust. The example I often give is, if someone were to come to you, an aeronautical engineer were to come to you and show you a flimsy flying machine made out of matchsticks and paper, and would prove to you mathematically that it can fly, carrying you inside it. Nobody else, but carrying you, it can fly. And he says to you, do you believe me? Having gone through all the calculations, and you understand the calculations. I say, yeah, I believe you. He says, good, then please be my guest. You say, that not. Do you not believe? No, you believe, but you don't have faith. There is a major step between belief and faith, between emunah and bitachon. And very often people question themselves incorrectly. They say, maybe I don't believe in God. That's not the issue. Most people do believe in God. The question is, do we have faith in God? Do we trust God? And why it is that we often don't trust him is an interesting discussion altogether. Why it is that people who believe in him might not trust him. And why it is that our main effort is to reach a level of trust rather than belief. Belief is quite easy. It's quite hard not to believe in God. But it's very difficult to trust God. Very, very difficult. And God does certain things that makes it even harder. That's the truth of it. But God doesn't make it easy for us to trust him. To believe in him, yes. We've got all of history to prove it, to know it, to feel it. To believe in God, yes. To feel God, to experience God. All of these things, yes. But to really trust him, that becomes very much more difficult. And we'll try and understand something of that today. One of the cause of the whole issue of trust of God, not belief in God, but trust in God, is a piece of Gemara that appears in Brachos Daf Lamed Hay, where the Gemara says the following. Tana Rabbon, and we learned in a brisa. The Osafto de Gonechot says in the second paragraph of the Shema, you shall collect your produce. You should go into the fields and harvest your produce. Why does it have to tell us that you must go into the field and harvest your produce? Everybody knows that. Not so simple, says the Gemara. L'fishenema, because it says in Yoshua, Lo yomush sefer ha-Torah azeh mipicha, yomun v'layla. This Torah should not disappear from your mouth day or night. There is an instruction to be learning 24 hours a day. Yochil dvorim kiksovim, I might have thought that means literally that you have to be learning 24 hours a day. Talmud Lomar, that's why it tells us in the Shema, Va'asafta digonecho. You need time to harvest your produce. Hanheg bohem minag derech eretz. Deal with the Torah in a normal, natural way. Don't have to be an angel. Deal normally. You need business, you need to invest, you need to plant, you need to harvest, you need to do normal things. Divrei Rabbi Yishmael, that's what Rabbi Yishmael says. Live a normal life, even though there's a statement of the Torah should not be away from your lips day and night. And it's clear, according to Rabbi Yishmael, what that means. That means that even while you're doing all these things, there should be some Torah value, there should be spiritual value, there should be intellectual thought in everything that you're doing. But don't detach yourself from normal existence in order to study the Torah on a permanent basis. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says, remember, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai was the man who for many years lived in a cave. And miraculous, a carob tree and a well of water appeared. And some say it still exists, that they take you on the tour guide, the tour guide show this place to you in Israel, which is apparently his cave, and the carob tree which is still there. And he lived on those caribs in that water for many years. And Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says, he was hiding away from the Romans, he didn't do it as his idea of fun, it was he had no choice. But he says, Hefshar Adam Chirish Bishas Charisha Vazorea Bishas Zeria Vakirtze Bishas Katsira Vadash Bishas Disho Vazori Bishas Haruach. Is it possible that the Torah expects a person to plow in the season of plowing, to plant in the season of planting, to harvest in the season of harvesting, to winnow in the season of winnowing? Torah might say, when exactly will he learn? When will he develop his mind? When will he develop his soul? If that's what he does. And if the Jews are fulfilling their purpose, their material needs will be taken care of by others. They will not have to work the fields. Their material needs will be taken care of by others. It's interesting, the whole Zionist movement, the whole Zionist Chalutz movement was designed for the ideal of Jews need to work the land of Israel too. We shouldn't rely on Arabs. We should plow the land and we should plant the land and we should... That's never been our ideal. The best is to get other people to do that. There's no reason why the Jews must plow the land. Why must a Jew plow the land? Pay Arabs to plow the land. It's not a big mitzvah for a Jew to plow the land, as long as the Jew owns the land. The Jew should own the land, develop the vision of what the land of Israel can be, build commerce in the land of Israel, build scholarship in the land of Israel, make Israel contributory in the world, but to go in the pick and a shovel and to start digging in the fields, the Jews aren't designed for that. That's not what they're good at. They've never been good at that. That's not their area of contribution to the world. And that was never the intention, that was not what God made Israel for. Says Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, if the Jews will be fulfilling their purpose, others will do all that. They'll have time to learn, to study, to develop themselves, and to make a spiritual and intellectual contribution to the world, not an agricultural contribution. And therefore, Ve'asafta degonecho, he says, this that the Shema says, you will harvest your produce, that's bizman she'en Yisrael o'sin return Hashem o'chum, when the Jewish people are not doing God's will. Then malachta na'aseh sal yedei atzmon, they have to do it themselves. So we have two views here as to what the ideal is. Rabbi Yishmael says it was never intended for the Jew to isolate himself from normal commercial activity in order to learn the Torah. Except for temporary periods of time, clearly, if he wants to take a few years off to prepare himself to study, to become great in the Torah. But that he should see as an ideal the disengagement from commercial life in order to engage in religious life, that was never the intention. And so we have two opposing verses. One says you will harvest your produce, and one says the words of the Torah will never be away from your mouth. One of them can't be literal. One of them we've got to say is figurative. Which is it? Says Rabbi Yishmael, that the Torah must never be away from your mouth. That's figurative. It doesn't mean that you've always got a book in front of you and that you never engage in normal business activity. And Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says, no. The ideal is that you have others to do that, and you sit and you study the Torah, there's nothing else to do. That would be the ideal. The Gemara goes on to say, "Harbe asu k'rabbi Yishmael, also b'yodon k'rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, v'lo also b'yodon." Many have tried Rabbi Yishmael's way, the more natural way, and they have been successful. Many have tried Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai's way, giving up any kind of commercial activity and dedicating themselves only to the Torah, and they have not been successful. Implying that the way for the ordinary person, normal person, is to live a normal life. Now, in this area of how much effort we're supposed to put in and how much we can leave to God, and commerce is a very interesting area to explore it, because that's where it's really meaningful on a day-to-day level, and we can really test the limits of the philosophy of what it really means. Do we need to engage in commerce? Can we leave it to God? How much do we need to engage in commerce, and how much can we leave to God? There's a lot of confusion in the area, and for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that there are different views, and each has a place. All these different views have places, and I'm going to try and navigate you through all these different views in a way that makes sense for people such as ourselves. What I'm saying isn't necessarily the way it would work with every single individual. Different people have different ways of dealing with it, but because there are so many different ways of dealing with it, there is a lot of confusion. For example, an oft-quoted statement in this regard is one by Reb Zundel Salant. Reb Zundel Salant was a little known but very important person. He was a Talmid, he was a disciple of Reb Chaim Volozhiner. The master, the real source of our modern school of learning was the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon had very few disciples. His Torah really came to us through one major disciple, that was Reb Chaim Volozhiner, Reb Chaim of Volozhin. And he started the yeshiva world, he innovated a whole new way of teaching and spreading Torah. So all of modern Torah learning, Lithuania and parts of Poland, all the learning that we have today, originates from the Vilna Gaon as taught by Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Reb Chaim Volozhiner had various different disciples. The technical learning part was transmitted through the house of the Soloveitchiks, the Briskis. And until today, there's Soloveitchik somewhere in the United States, some still are, some in Yerushalayim. That was the line of really meticulous transmission of the logical methodology of the Vilna Gaon. The philosophic methodology of the Vilna Gaon and the moral methodology of the Vilna Gaon and the Reb Chaim Volozhiner went through Reb Zundel Salant. And he had a disciple who was Reb Yisrael Salanter. Reb Yisrael Salanter was the founder of the Muslim movement. So Reb Zundel Salanter didn't write very much, and that's why he's not so well known, but very, very, a very important link in our tradition. And he is supposed to have said that his shtadlus, his effort, what does he do in order to make sure that he doesn't rely on miracles? He buys a lottery ticket once a week, so that if God wants to give him money, it won't look unnatural. That's all he did. For the rest of the time, he was learning, he was studying, and that's all. He wasn't prepared to waste any time doing anything other than learning. He said, what about earning a lottery ticket? That's the way he did it. I don't know how successful he was in his lottery ticket. That part of the story I've never had anybody tell me. The first part is quite well known. And from that kind of story, you often get the view put, the religious view put, that, you know, working for a living and all, that this is a very... it's not really what one's supposed to be doing if one's really on the higher levels. The right thing is not to do that kind of stuff, but to devote oneself entirely to Torah. And I'm going to challenge that and explain Reb Zundel in its correct perspective. Where does the need to earn, to work for a living, originate? Where does it start from? If we want to know why did God make the world in such a way that we have to work, if he wanted us to learn and to grow spiritually and to become great in Torah, why did he create an imperative to spend so much time on the physical necessities of survival? Why did he do that, and when did he do that? The Gemara says, the Yalkut Shimoni brings it, that when God put man in the Garden of Eden, and it says in the Torah, La'ovda u'lashomra, to work it and protect it. And the Chazal ask, what work and what protection did it need? There were rivers that were flowing, water came down, it didn't need to be watered, it didn't need to be harvested, there was nothing that needed to be done. What does it mean man was put in the Garden of Eden to work it and to protect it? But Chazal points out that that's put in the feminine form. It doesn't say to work it masculine and protect it masculine, noting that the garden, the subject of that sentence, is a masculine noun. So it should say le'ovdo or le'shomro. That's what it should say, to work and to protect it in the masculine, which would clearly mean the garden. It says to protect and to work and protect her. And Chazal say that means the Torah, that doesn't mean the garden. He was put in the Garden of Eden so that he would be able to dedicate all of his time to things spiritual. And that was the Garden of Eden. There was no need to do anything physical, because as the Gemara says, Malachim tzorim loy boso, that angels used to come and used to barbecue meat for Adam and Chava, and they used to pour wine for Adam and Chava. So there wasn't any kind of diminishment of an engagement in material pleasure, but there was no need to work for it. The work they put into the spiritual and ideological and intellectual world, and the rewards they got directly from God, that God took care of everything they needed physically. So we've got to picture life in the Garden of Eden before the sin. Life in the Garden of Eden before the sin is not one moment would have been wasted earning a living or working for a living. That was not necessary. God himself, by means of angels, had a room service arrangement of the highest quality with Adam and Chava. Whatever they want was presented on a silver tray, beautifully presented, magnificently prepared. They had to do nothing. All they had to do was la'ovda and la'shomra, to work and protect the Torah, the concepts of the Torah, the spirituality and sanctity of God. Then came the sin. And then what does God say? Bezeyata pecha toichaloch. Now you will eat bread by the sweat of your brow. For the first time you'll have to work. Now what's important is, what is that? What are the consequences of that work? The consequences of that work are trade. Because if until then whatever you needed for survival was provided by God free of charge, then it had no commercial value. So just as oxygen is provided free of charge and therefore has no commercial value, because God provides enough of it, and water theoretically has no commercial value, its commercial value lies in bringing it to your house. But as such, if you want to go and get your own water from natural resources, you can do so. The things that God has provided us with abundantly have no commercial value. Before the sin, God provided us with everything we needed. So imagine society would have grown and there wouldn't have been a sin. And we would now have had millions of people served by angels with whatever they wanted. There would have been no place for trade. There would have been no money. There would have been no dealing. Because nothing would have had commercial value. Does that mean nothing would have had value? Of course it would have had value. It would only have had spiritual value. Spiritual value would have been the only value of any kind of consequence. The market wouldn't have existed. There wouldn't have been a market. That's what happened. The consequences of man's sin, when God says, "Bezeyas apecha teichalochim," it doesn't mean by the sweat of the brow you eat bread. That means you have to go and work the ground to make your bread. And what about your shoes? Well, you'll have to barter your bread to get your shoes. So you start with a market. That's how it would have to happen. There's supply and there's demand. So the existence of trade and commerce as we know it today was the outcome of the sin of Adam. It was as an outcome of the sin of Adam that there are now two value systems working in the world. There is spiritual value and there's commercial value. Spiritual value is determined by one market, and that's God. God determines what's valuable and what isn't. Commercial value, we determine. And Bezeyas Apecho means you are now no longer dependent only on God. You are now dependent on other human beings. If they like what you're offering, they will pay you for it. If they don't like what you're offering, even if it's very good, they won't pay you for it. And that's the Bezeyas Apecho, that's the sweat. You're going to have to sweat to please your customer, quite apart from pleasing God. You've now got two authorities in your life. You've got a market, and you've got God. You've got spiritual values, and you've got commercial value. You've got supply and demand, and you've got absolute value. And you're going to have to balance these things. And we're going to discuss that briefly in a few moments. Let us take a step back a moment, though, and say, commercial activity, therefore, is a consequence of the sin. Consequence of the sin doesn't mean it's a punishment. Consequence of the sin means that Adam designed a new state for the human being in which to operate. That state requires trade and commerce. You can't operate in the world that Adam designed when he disobeyed God without trade and commerce. And trade and commerce becomes our means of tikkun. Tikkun means repair. If God says the result of eating from the tree is bezeyas apech, you're going to have to sweat and you're going to have to deal commercially, then what God is saying, through dealing in commercially, you will be able to recover your pre-sin situation. That's how important trade and commerce is after the sin. So while I say it's the consequence of the sin, I'm not saying it's a punishment. It's the route back to our origin. It's the way of elevating society back to one value system. We'll discuss that and explain it in greater detail, but meanwhile I have the following question to put to you. So, trade and commerce is the outcome of sin. Where do we have the specific injunction for trade and commerce? V'osafta d'gonecho, you shall go and you shall harvest your fields. Don't think that you sit and learn day and night, says Rabbi Shmuel. You've got to be normal. And that means work the fields, go and harvest. What does it say in the Shema just before that? Look where that word comes in context. V'hoyo and it shall be. Im shamoya tishmu, if you will surely listen to God, and you will observe His mitzvahs, b'chol levavchem u'b'chol nafshechem, with all your heart and with all your soul. Then what? And when asati matabatchem, then I will give you rainfall and your fields will produce, and you will harvest your produce. So what do we see this all as an outcome of? Absolute perfection. God doesn't say it's a punishment, and you know what? If you don't learn well, you'll have to harvest the fields. If you don't keep Shabbos, you'll have to harvest the fields. He doesn't say that. He says, Im shamoya tishmu, if you keep every word of the Torah, and you keep it b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha, with all of your heart and with all of your soul, you do it all, everything, with total commitment, then I will give rain, your fields will grow, and you will have to work in your fields. Does that sound like an outcome of punishment? Does that sound like an outcome of sin? What's it doing there? That's the most important question we have to answer. If asafta d'gonecho is the outcome of sin, if harvesting your fields is the outcome of sin ultimately, why does it find itself in the beginning of the second paragraph of the Shema? Let's go back to what we were discussing about the origin of trade and commerce. What happened there? What did Adam do? What was going on? Let's look at the Garden of Eden before the sin, the Garden of Eden after the sin, through the eyes of Adam. Garden of Eden before the sin. The spiritual world was reality. You could see it, sense it, feel it, with as much clarity and certainty as you can now feel the physical world. That's what the Garden of Eden was. When angels brought meat and wine, you saw they were angels, they came from God. You were interacting with God openly, the way we interact with each other. There was, when we talked last week about the difficulties of accessing soul to soul, that's all since the sin. Before the sin, in the Garden of Eden, that was the natural way of communicating, of sensing, of feeling. You didn't need your body. Your body was a vehicle for higher things. You didn't need your body for sensing, because you sensed with your soul. And your interactions were soul to soul, all the time. Soul, God's soul to my soul, your soul to my soul, object soul to soul, everything was soul to soul. That existence denies understanding of evil. It denies understanding of wrong, of bad. So there's a whole part of the world that Adam recognizes he knows nothing about. And he considers his knowledge, therefore, to be incomplete. And his experience, which means the experience of mankind, is therefore incomplete. We know about soul, that the fact that we use soul to access our experiences means that we don't have any kind of knowledge or experience of evil and bad. And Adam decides with Chava, with Eve, his wife, that they want to experience evil. So they disobey God to get into the world of evil. What happens to the world at that point? Reality switches. Now reality becomes physical, and the spiritual becomes illusion. Now when the spiritual was real before the sin, and the physical was illusion, did that mean the physical didn't exist? No, didn't mean that at all. It meant that one day some professor would probably give a talk and say, you know, there is a physical world. And some people, it is possible that when you drink a glass of wine, you don't access the soul of that wine, but it could be possible that you could access the taste on a more animal, physical kind of level. And some people would say, you're talking nonsense. And some people would say, maybe the world would be divided into believers and non-believers. Those who believe in the fact of the existence of a physical world, and those who don't. The truth is, there is a physical world, but not everybody would believe it because it wouldn't be able to be sensed. It would be an illusion, or it could be an illusion. The coin was flipped after the sin. The coin was flipped after the sin, and come sit down, Elisa, sit down. Give the door a bang and sit down. Give the door a bang and sit down. There's it. The worst thing when one's disturbing is to do it gently, because it takes much longer. You're disturbing, to come in, bang the door, close, sit down, and we can move on. The whole thing flips, and the physical world now becomes real, and the spiritual world becomes illusionary. And now you get professors getting up and saying, you know, there is a spiritual world, there's a God, there are forces of good and evil, there's a morality. And some people say, yes. And some people say, you're out of your mind. In a moment, everything flipped. The moment Adam chose to explore the world of evil, the physical world became the real sensing world, and the spiritual world became something beyond him, something he had to access using soul, but wasn't accessing naturally. Only one could be accessed spontaneously and intuitively. The other had to be worked on. When he was in the pre-sin world, he accessed soul naturally and would have to work to access the physical. When he was in the post-sin period, which is now, he accesses the physical naturally and has to work to access the soul. What is the result of that? The result of that is that now there's natural scientific cause and effect. The result is that now it is possible for man to believe that he is master of his own destiny, whereas previously that would be impossible to believe. When the angels were bringing you your food every day, you couldn't believe you were master of your destiny. You didn't know how to find food, you didn't know how to make food, nor did you have to. Your survival was completely in the hands of God, and that was fine because you trusted God 100%. He was always on time with his deliveries, whatever you needed was there, and it was more delicious than anything you could make because it was soul that you were experiencing, not just the physical, or hardly the physical at all. And so there was no question that you were not master of your own destiny. Exactly the same as the Jews who were in the desert during the time of the Exodus. When they used to get manna every day, they knew they weren't masters of their own destiny, and that's why the Gemara says that's why they got the Torah and not us. Because to access the Torah, you had to get beyond believing that you're master of your own destiny. Once you believe, or could believe, once the human being has the capacity to believe that he's master of his own destiny, the seeds of evil are planted. Because then anything's possible. Now you start designing philosophies, now you start designing moralities, now you start justifying, anything is possible. You're master of your own destiny, there is no yiro, there's no fear of God. Because God is not the master, I am the master. And now, if you look at what happens, it's quite a cruel trick. Because now God says the following. Let me put the following question to you first. What is more rational? the pre-sin state or the post-sin state? Well, let me put it a little bit more clearly, and not quite the same. Is it more rational if God would come and deliver your food every day and everything you needed and nothing would have commercial value? Would that be a more rational existence? Or having to work for a living, make money, put money in the bank, spend the money the way we appear to be living today? Which is more rational? Any views? Very good. They are equally rational. As long as you know the rules, they're equally rational. The one's rule is God gives, and He gives consistently. Every morning He gives breakfast. You know how it works. There's no question. You're accessing it by soul. It's perfectly rational to that kind of reasoning. If it's cause and effect, that whatever effort you put in, you get out, absolutely rational. There's one thing that isn't rational. When God says, act as if you're master of your destiny, but believe that you're not. That's paradox. And that's not rational. And that's what God is asking of us. God is not saying go back to the pre-sin era and live as if there's no cause and effect, as if it's all supernatural. No. God is not saying it's all natural. The harder you work, the more you'll make. We know that's not so. The harder you labor, the more you make. Then people who carry heavy loads and laborers should earn the highest wages. But they don't. And if you say no, it's the people who make the biggest contribution that make the most money. Well, do nurses and teachers make all to contribution? There are people who make no contribution yet gain enormous reward, and there are people who make little contribution, there are people who make great contributions and get very little, and there are people who work terribly hard and earn very little, and there are people who hardly work at all and they make fortunes. So one thing we know for sure is that the logic of normal cause and effect is not what's at play here. Nor is the godly system. It's not that if you study Torah, then God will give you money. If you don't study Torah, He won't. You break Shabbos, you'll make no money. You keep Shabbos, you'll get... That's also not the system. So what is the system? The system is act as if it's all your efforts, and don't believe that for a moment. And that's the paradox. That's why Bitochen is so hard. When I said in the beginning, it's easy to have belief, but it's hard to trust. Because our actions deny the very thing we're being asked to trust. We're being asked to act as if we don't trust, and yet to trust all the time. An amazing thing.
It becomes a little easier. Because those people who are in business on their own will know that all too often, the things you pursue are not the things you get. But if you didn't pursue them, you wouldn't get anything. But you pursue A, and you land up getting B. You think you go after customer A, and you invest enormous effort into customer A, and you don't get customer A. But because you were busy doing A and B, trying to get customer A, somebody else heard about you, and you got customer B. That happens over and over and over again. We have little reminders like that, that tell us that you had to be working, otherwise you wouldn't have got it. But don't think that the direction you were going is the direction God had in mind. The outcome is different from the input. It becomes a little bit more complex. I'm not going to take you much further this evening. We'll develop it further next week. But it becomes a little bit more complicated, because as far as delivery to your customer is concerned, that's a chesed. That's kindness. You're performing a service, or you're providing goods to a customer. That means you're doing him a service. You're doing him a kindness. The fact that he pays for it doesn't matter. It's still a kindness. Kindness is a mitzvah. Mitzvahs God doesn't control. God doesn't make you do mitzvahs, and God doesn't make you do averus. So if providing your customer with a service or with goods is a mitzvah, which it is, who is in control of that destiny? I am. So I can't blame God for falling down on delivery to my customer. The only thing I'm not in control of is how rich I am at the end. That's not in my control. Sometimes you make money, but there are expenditures. Sometimes things get lost. Sometimes the economy changes. There are all sorts of things that can impact on my wealth, other than my labor and my contribution. So I have to take complete responsibility for delivering my service or my merchandise to my customer, because that's a mitzvah. The reward I get from it is beyond my control. That doesn't mean I take no account of it, that I don't watch it carefully, I do whatever I can. But I need to know that that's not going to be the determining factor. What determines the outcome is different to what I to what I expect and what I think. Now let me take you back to the Shema. There is a difference between the first paragraph and the second paragraph of the Shema. It's one word. There are a few differences, but in terms of tonight's discussion, one word's different. The first paragraph says, the first paragraph's in the singular, the second paragraph's in the plural, perhaps we'll discuss that another time. What's important is the following. The first paragraph says, Ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha, you shall love the Lord your God, b'chol levavcha, with all your heart, just as the second paragraph says, b'chol nafshecha, with all your soul. What do those things mean? B'chol levavcha means with all your passion. Good passion, bad passion, everything. Throw it all into serving God. Chol, nafshecho means your life force. All your energy. Even if you die doing so, that's why we have to give our lives for God if necessary. Chol levavcho v'chol nafshecho. All your passion and all your energy. That word comes in the second paragraph too. But the first paragraph has a third term. V'chol me'odecho, which means with all your economic force too. You serve God with your passion, your energy, and your economic force. In the second paragraph it says, you serve God with your passion and your energy, not your economic force. What's the difference between the man in the first paragraph and the man in the second paragraph? The man in the first paragraph will give his life for Torah, but not his money. Now that might sound odd, but it isn't odd. It's the norm. Most of us, believe it or not, would give our lives. If we found ourselves in the situation that so many of our brethren did 50 years ago, and we were asked to deny any association with the Jewish people and with God and with the Torah in order to save our lives, he would be surprised what distant Jews would suddenly become religious and say, no, that I won't do. I am Jewish and I stand up for my Jewishness, and if you kill me for that, you kill me. Many, many people would do that. That somehow is easier than doing it with our money. The Chazon Ish gives a lovely example of a man who claims that he believes in God and he trusts God and he's religious and God will make do and Emirza Hashem and Baruch Hashem and all the rest of it is completely religious, until a competitor opens up across the road and he starts becoming ruthless and cruel and deceitful. He says that's the test of the religiousness of the person, the degree to which you're trusting in God when you're under threat, not when things are easy. When your life is under threat, your response is very often to become even more Jewish. When your money is under threat, the response is very often to find a way out. That's the way we are with money. And we can discuss why that is. But the second paragraph is talking about a person who doesn't commit himself to God with his money. With his life, yes, with his energy, with his passion, but not with his money. First paragraph, with his money as well. So where does V'asafta D'gonecha come? That if you are a person who has not yet overcome the sin of Adam, as most of us are, that means your passion is God's and your life force is God's. But when it comes to money, you believe that the money belongs to you. As long as you believe the money belongs to you, the osafta d'gonecho, you have to engage in commerce, because you have not yet rectified the whole process. The whole process is to get yourself back to the realization that you are not the master of your own destiny. That although you work in business, the outcome of that, as far as your own wealth is concerned, is not in your hand. Because then you can move back to the pre-sin era, theoretically. At least as an individual, the society might not be there. But if one isn't holding at that point, if one is holding a point where one believes one's money is one's own, why is my money mine? Because I worked for it. If you believe that your money is yours because you worked for it, then you haven't begun the process of using commerce to rebuild faith. Because that's the purpose of commerce. Commerce is the ability of throwing yourself in something which appears to be so normal in one level and means religiously something opposite. And to manage that paradox in the midst of that. To manage paradox, to manage Torah and religion when you're in shul, that's relatively easy. You have to concentrate a little bit, but it's relatively easy. To manage it when you're saying a bracha, when you're davening, relatively easy. You're putting on tefillin, relatively easy. You're learning a piece of Gemara, relatively easy. To manage it when your actions are the opposite, when you're working in business, to be able to say, but the money I get isn't mine. The money I get is God's. That's a gift from God. I have to make a contribution. I have to work. But the result, the reward is a gift from God. That's operating on a different plane altogether. And until one gets there, one has to stay in business. In the second paragraph of the Shema, you have to engage in commerce until you're at the point of the Chol Moedecho. In the first paragraph, it doesn't say V'asafta D'Gonecho. In the first paragraph, you don't have to do that because you've moved beyond that into that pre-sin era. And we're talking about a theoretical model, not something which is very practical for you and I, who will always be somewhere between one extreme and another in the second paragraph of the Shema level. But we need to know what the ideal is that we're working towards. Reb Zundel Salant was one of those individuals, like Reb Shimon ben Yochai, who had made that transition. So he says to himself, I want to spend my life creating spiritual value. I'm not interested in markets. You'll say, but Reb Zundel, you're not interested in markets. How will you eat? He says, you know, Adam in the Garden of Eden, God brought him food. I believe I'm at a level of trust that God will do that for me too. And there are people today who are on this level, by the way, and it works. It works for them. It won't work if you're not on the level. But there are individuals who are on that level, and it works. Reb Zundel Salant says, I'm on that level where I can spend my time creating spiritual value, irrespective of whether the market values it or not. I don't need the market because I don't want money for it. I don't want to contaminate it with money. What am I going to eat? I'll buy a lottery ticket. That means God can bring me money in ways that don't look miraculous. Because once they start looking miraculous, it gives away the secret. Once things start looking miraculous, you start understanding the formula that is meant to be hidden. You start understanding the chok. You start understanding the statute of business. The mishpat of business, the logic and the rationale of business is normal laws of economics, and we have to engage in that. But buried deep in business is a soul. And the soul of that business, the chok is, the reward is from God, the reward is not from the customer. The reward is from God, the reward is not from the boss. That's the chok, that's the mystery that one has to try and penetrate. And so when Francine asked the question of, is trust in God chok or is it mishpat? Trusting God while acting as if you don't is chok. Just to trust God in a kind of theoretical way, that's easy, that's mishpat. But to live a normal life, operate according to the mishpatim, according to the rational laws of nature and of commerce and of the markets in which we operate, and yet to access the soul of those markets and understand that we're operating in something religious at the same time, and that God plays a part in that too, particularly when it comes to reward, that's chok. Of course, the question that is left, which we're not going to answer tonight, is if the man who labors the hardest doesn't make the most money, and the man who makes the biggest contribution doesn't make the most money, surely the man who's most moral should make the most money? Why is it that even the laws of morality don't work? Not only don't the normal laws of cause and effect, but even God's laws don't seem to work when we look and understand and how God dishes out prosperity. We're talking not only about financial prosperity, but about all kinds of prosperity and all kinds of adversity. But the people who are struck with adversity are not always bad people, they're often incredibly good people. And the people who are blessed with prosperity are not always good people, they're sometimes very bad people. And dealing with the justice of that, is that also just chok? Or is there mishpat in that as well? Is there justice or is that mystery? And how do we separate the two, and how do we resolve the paradox of those, is the area that we'll start exploring next week, next Monday night. Thank you.
Just would like to make a few announcements. First of all, I'd like to thank Rabbi Lappin for giving, once again, an outstanding share. I just